T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Here's a long clip shot, broken up by Kent. He tries to get it out. What a play, Nurse, to keep it alive. Neal to Nurse, the shot. He fired it wide. Hawks win. Hawks win. The Chicago Blackhawks have won a series for the first time since the Stanley Cup Championship of 2015. Hawks win. Series over. They're into the final 16.
NBC Sports Chicago. That was Pat Foley, Hall of Fame broadcaster, calling the dying seconds of the dying play-in round. The Blackhawks beat the Oilers 3-1. They went up to Edmonton, played on, well, it used to be really good ice, but Edmonton ice in September is not that good. Although it was good for the Blackhawks. They found a way to beat Connor McJesus, Leon Draisaitl, who might be the MVP, and that was about all the Oilers had. And the Hawks had the veteran core, some young kids stepping up, and Corey Crawford looking like Corey Crawford for the last two periods, and that was enough. And it was part of a wild, wild Friday in the NHL. Welcome in, welcome back. I'm Steve Rosenblum. Over there is Tom Thayer. He's the one waving his hand. Wave your hand, Tom. That's it. That's it. Good job. We're going to the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Welcome in. Co-host with Jay Zawoski of the Madhouse Podcast, NBC5 Sports. He is James Naveau. And James, you ran a... Update us on the poll you ran on Twitter. Does it make me a dumb hockey fan that I'm pumped the Blackhawks have made the playoffs instead of having a 12.5% chance of landing the number one pick, and Alex Lafreniere, who is supposed to be the next Connor McJesus? How's that poll
going? Well, I mean, I had to ask the question after last season when the Blackhawks lucked into the number three overall pick in the draft. I just wanted to make sure that Blackhawks fans were happy, that I should be happy, I suppose. And as it turns out, about 85% of people said, no, I am not a dumb hockey fan, and that I am absolutely right to be excited that the Blackhawks are back in the postseason officially now, not just the qualifying round or whatever wording the NHL wants to use. But apparently I'm smart to be happy that they're advancing to the next round to play either Colorado or Vegas.
Hey, James. So last night, first period, 14-44, it's tied 1-1. What did you think from that moment on? Did you think this was going to be a 6-5 type of game or as tight as it was?
Well, I mean, I think just based on what we had seen previously in the series, I fully expected it to devolve into a defense optional complete and total shootout, and that's obviously not what ended up happening. And a large share of the credit does have to be given to Corey Crawford just based on how well he played last night. I felt like the first two games in the series especially, you could tell he was really rusty. There was a lot. He was just trying to kind of catch up to the game, whether it was related to recovering from the coronavirus or just the extremely long layoff and the very short preparation time that he had. Whatever it was, Crawford didn't look like himself in those first two games, and then you started to see him kind of turn the corner in game three. He started to look a lot better, a lot more like his old self, and then last night I felt like was vintage Corey Crawford, moving around the crease very effectively, very quickly, played with a lot of confidence, and that's the kind of performance that you're going to need from a guy like Corey Crawford when you're facing an offense like Edmonton's. I thought that his performance kind of turned the tide in that game and really turned it into a little bit more of a chess match probably than the other three games in the series tended to be.
Talking with James Naveau, co-host with Jay Zawoski of The Score on the Madhouse podcast. It's a terrific, knowledgeable listen for Hawks fans, and we're talking the Blackhawks move into the Stanley Cup playoffs for the first time since 2017. So one of the things that going in to this play-in series was I looked at Jeremy Colliton and largely unfit to be an NHL coach. He had not proven anything to me other than he looks pretty good in a suit and he is relatively unflappable, which is fine, but we're used to crotch-grabbing coaches around here because they win. And one of the things that when he took over Quenneville, his team's lost like 14 to 17 games. When he had his own training camp, his team lost, I think, 9 of the first 12 games. He never got a team prepared to start. His team was prepared to start. Now, it might have been just Jonathan Toews saying, hey, guys, follow me. But whatever, he didn't get in the way. And I thought he showed progress as the series went on in showing faith in his fourth line that was repaid. I mean, it was a high events line. But I thought in rolling four lines, he got the most out of his team. What did you see progress in Jeremy Colliton's coaching? And if so, where?
I think that we can agree that there were still probably decisions that Colliton made that have kind of made us scratch our heads a little bit, whether it's the continued insertion of Alex Nylander into the lineup or what have you. But there were a lot of things that he did right in the series, and I do think he deserves praise for. I think that the Blackhawks' adjustments that they were able to make on the power play, especially in game one of the series and then in game four, are definitely noteworthy for him, and he still hasn't quite gotten that formula right. It's something that he's obviously continuing to work on. But then as the series went on, I felt like his execution of like making sure that he got specific matchups, whether it was sending out David Camp or Jonathan Toews against Connor McDavid, whether it was the penalty killing strategy that the Blackhawks used, all of those things did tend to get a little bit better in the series. And I want to really hammer home the point about that penalty kill. In the first game, the Blackhawks looked completely outmatched against Edmonton's power play. They went 1-for-4 in that game. Edmonton was just scoring at will on the man advantage. And then as the series went on, that penalty kill really started to kind of dial in and really start to stop the Oilers. The penalty kill, I think, stopped 11 of the last 13 power plays that Edmonton had. And I do think a share of the credit for the success of that penalty killing unit does have to go to Jeremy Colliton. And finally, the other thing that I really liked about what his strategy and what the scheme was in the last couple of games of that series was just how active the defense was. And I know that Colliton has emphasized that at times in the past with guys like Adam Boqvist and Erik Gustafsson, but I really felt that guys like Slater Koekkoek and Duncan Keith and Olli Maatta all were getting involved and getting shots on that and really causing a lot of issues for the Edmonton defense. And I do have to give credit to Colliton for kind of identifying that as a potential issue and then going out and exploiting it.
Hey, James, before the start of the third period, the announcers were saying that they're concerned because they feel the Hawks are passing up an opportunity for shots on goal. So they didn't have a lot of them in the third period, but is that something that can be just easily preached if they have any practice preparation, or is it a conscious effort to, you know, to take some shots that maybe you're not in the best position, but it's still a shot on goal?
I think the key is just to try to keep the opponent as off balance as possible. And I think that when the Blackhawks kind of get into that mode, and you saw this on the power play, especially in games 2 and 3, when they're looking for the perfect shot instead of trying to take a shot with traffic in front of the nets or with the Oilers defense scrambling, I think that that's something the Blackhawks can definitely kind of look to build on. They do need to be more aggressive with their shot taking, honestly. I know that a lot of times hockey fans, especially on social media, kind of deride those who will yell shoot from the 300 level of the United Center. But at the same time, we saw the results of that in Game 3. Matthew Highmore and Jonathan Toews both scored on deflected goals. In Game 4, you once again had Highmore scoring on a deflected goal. Connor Murphy scored on a goal with a bunch of traffic in front of the net. You have to take advantage of those situations, and the whole key with shooting is, no, you don't want to give the goalie a wide open view of what's coming and then just kind of go from there. But if you can get traffic to the front of the net like the Blackhawks can, and they can with guys like Jonathan Toews and Kirby Dach and Dominic Kubalik, it's never a bad idea to put the puck on net in those situations. And they do need to stop passing up some of their scoring opportunities. One of the guys who definitely falls into that category is Kirby Dach. He passed up several scoring opportunities in the series. Kind of was the only blemish on his record, honestly, in the four games. I just think that the Blackhawks have seen that that shoot-first mentality can work, because you can either get those deflections or you can get really good rebounds, and we saw that in Game 4, and they should continue to do that moving forward.
Our guest is James Naveau, NBC5 Chicago, a co-host with Jay Zawoski on Madhouse Podcast. You know, it's not just the 300 level yelling shoot, because with no fans in the building, it's players on the bench yelling it too. So it's not just leave the fans alone. They were right. They knew they should have shot. And one of the problems was Duncan Keith couldn't always get the shot through, and understandably was reluctant. And Brent Seabrook, when he would be the other on the other point, he couldn't always get a shot through. And if Seabrook's shot hit somebody, you were looking at a potential breakaway. Could have been, it was going to be a shot on goal the other way. So that led to a lot of static power plays. And now they found ways to have confidence to get the shots through. And the big target in front, Kirby Dach, is a bigger target than he was when the season was suspended. He looks like the rookie who comes back, as football coaches famously say, the biggest improvement is from freshman to sophomore year. That's what he looks like. He looks like the guy who would have shown up for the next training camp bigger, stronger, and ready to be the number two center and learn from Jonathan Toews. Only he gets a huge advantage by doing it in the playoffs. This is phenomenal. Even if the Hawks don't have a shot at Alex Lafreniere, their number three draft choice is going to play like a top of the draft pick, and he's looking like it now.
Well, and I mean, there was rightfully some skepticism when the Blackhawks took him just because of who they passed up. I know that Bowen Byram was at the top of the wish list for a lot of Blackhawks fans going into last year's draft. But before they made the selection, during some of the podcasts we had done, Jay and I, leading up to the draft, I had mentioned that Kirby Dach does a lot of little things well that could potentially make him an effective top six center, whether it's winning puck battles along the boards because he's got the physicality and the size to do it, whether he's got a shot in front of the net in a very tight space. It seemed like he has very quick wrists and is able to really get a lot of shots on net from that area, or even just parking himself in front of the net and creating issues for goaltenders. All of those things really stood out when you watched his junior tape. And then he kind of had an abbreviated training camp because he ended up getting hurt in the Traverse City tournament last fall and really kind of struggled when he came into the NHL because he was still trying to play catch-up because of the limited training camp. But as the season went on in February and March, I felt like the confidence that he had in his own game was beginning to grow. He was starting to show some real signs of life. And then when the coronavirus pandemic kind of shut everything down, like you said, Steve, he went into the gym, he started lifting weights a little bit, putting some bulk on that frame like every single Blackhawks fan has kind of been hoping that he would do. And he's come out in these playoffs and he has just played with a confidence that is well beyond his years. And even though Dylan Strome has really struggled in this postseason, and he was obviously looked at to be probably your number two center going into a series like this, Kirby Dach has definitely taken over that role. And Jeremy Colliton, is credit to him also for this, is trusting Dach in all sorts of situations, not just at even strength. He's also trusting him on the power play and the penalty kill. It is a remarkable transformation for such a young player, and it should give Blackhawks fans a lot of hope for the future.
Hey, James, I have a question for you. Two opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, when you look at that redirect goal and you think about what the goalie is paying attention to, and all of a sudden you see the stick come out and redirects the puck into the net, is that something that the defenders have to get more bodies to keep the offensive player out of that area that can have such a significant role? Or Is it something that, you know, is it still the goalie's obligation at that point? It's almost, and I think it's one of the most amazing thing in sports to watch a redirected goal.
Well, I think for some goaltenders, it's probably more a matter of preference. Like, some goaltenders probably are okay if their teammates are trying to block shots in front of the net, while other goaltenders would kind of prefer that you try to clear that traffic out so they can get as good of a view of the puck as possible. And I think that one of the things the Blackhawks kind of made an adjustment on in Game 4 of the series is that they were really static in Games 2 and 3. Their forwards were not moving around enough. The Oilers were kind of able to collapse into the middle of the ice and block a lot of shots that the Blackhawks were putting towards the net, especially in Game 2 of the series. But then in Game 4, I felt like the Blackhawks did a really good job of kind of getting that movement going again, and that really not only kind of discombobulates the defense and prevents them from blocking those shots, but it also gives your players this opportunity as they're kind of skating through the middle of the ice to deflect the puck in. And that to me, Tom, is one of my favorite things to see, is a player kind of doing a flyby, a shot starts coming in from the point, and he's able to just bat it down with his stick. That is almost impossible for a goalie to adjust to, especially when it's in close. And the Blackhawks really executed that to perfection on multiple occasions. To be frank with you, I did not envy Mikko Koskinen having to deal with all of the traffic the Blackhawks are putting in front of him in Game 4. I thought they did a great job of eluding the Edmonton defense and creating some opportunities in that space.
Talking with James Naveau of the Madhouse Podcast with Jay Zawoski. And last week we talked with Jay, we sort of hit upon the idea that it was a nothing to lose mentality from the Hawks going in. The NHL jury-rigged the whole thing so that they could get the Canadians in and the Hawks in. And now the teams that rank 22nd, 23rd, and 24th in points percentage have all won their play-in series. The Coyotes, the Hawks, and the Canadiens in that order are now moving into the playoffs. And for the Hawks, veterans, it's a chance for them to look to recapture whatever they might recapture. But for the kids, it's a great opportunity to gain experience in with really nothing to lose, because it's kind of found money at whatever the cost of the number one draft pick might be. I think this overall is a good thing for the Blackhawks. I agree with your web poll. It might as well. It gives us something to root for. But now moving on to real teams, not just a two-man team in Edmonton. When you're talking Vegas with incredible depth and Colorado that, you know, stole the Blackhawks idea and just want to play the game so fast nobody can keep up. What will the Blackhawks face against one of those two teams?
Well, I think the thing that is going to kind of differentiate Colorado from Edmonton is simply the depth that they have. Like, yeah, they do have that high-end scoring talent with guys like Nathan MacKinnon and Cale Makar, but you go down their lineup, and it's not like Edmonton where you're kind of like scrapping for depth at the bottom of their lineup. You have guys like Gabriel Landeskog, you've got Andre Burakovsky, Nazem Kadri, Mikko Rantanen. These guys just have a preposterously deep lineup, and it is really hard. You can't just isolate like the MacKinnon line and say, okay, that's the one that we're going to stop. The Blackhawks are going to have to do a good job overall of defending the Avalanche if they were going to want to stop them in this series. And we saw during the regular season, the Blackhawks did struggle at that. They gave up almost 5 goals a game to the Avalanche. They only played 4 times, and the Avalanche just seemingly were scoring at will on them. That's where I think the emergence of guys like Ryan Carpenter and David Camp is going to be key, is because Jonathan Toews isn't just going to be able to be deployed against the number one line and expect to stop them. It's going to have to be a collective defensive effort from the forwards, and obviously the defensemen are going to have to step up in a big way. With Vegas, it's kind of a similar thing. They don't really have a Connor McDavid or a Leon Draisaitl on that team, but when you look at guys like Max Pacioretty, you look at a Mark Stone, you look at a William Karlsson, Shea Theodore even, they are, once again, just like the depth that Vegas has always kind of been their hallmark, especially the first year that they were in the league, that they went to the Stanley Cup final, and that's obviously going to set them apart from a team like Edmonton, who just seems to ride their two big horses, and that's it. Of course, I know Blackhawks fans are probably going to want to face Vegas because it means an opportunity to potentially face Robin Leonard in the postseason. And I know that that has to be something that Hawks fans would look forward to, just to kind of seeing how that would play out. But when you look at the goaltending for both of these teams, too, it's not like it gets any easier. This isn't a Mike Smith situation where you're going to hope that he makes some dumb mistake and it kind of frees you up to do something like the Hawks got in Game 1. All four of the goaltenders that play for these two teams are really talented, and the Blackhawks, just all they have to do is look up and down those lineups and go, man, that is going to be a really stressful challenge. And I know a lot of people have been going back and forth on which one would be better for the Blackhawks to play, and frankly, it's not like either of them are particularly ideal options.
Hey, James, I have one quick question for you. When I went to Notre Dame, Digger Phelps used to run this four-corner offense that used to bore the opponent if they were a high-scoring opponent. So I watched last night, and at the end of the game, they get into this four-corner pass of just trying to maintain possession of the puck. Is that, do they have a line specifically for that, or are you doing it with the group of guys that are on the ice?
I would think that the Blackhawks could probably put together a line that could execute a strategy like that, but I just think that their game is much more effective when it's going in a north-south orientation. I feel like the Blackhawks take advantage of chaos on the defensive side of things, and that's why you see guys like Dominic Kubalik repeatedly cutting to the net, because he's trying to, you know, kind of scramble up the defense a little bit there. I don't think the Blackhawks are really the kind of team to, proverbially take the air out of the puck, to borrow a phrase from basketball or football. I think that the Blackhawks are a lot better off when they're able to kind of get the defense kind of sprinting around in a bunch of different directions. And I don't know if that's really the strategy to kind of take out the Avalanche. I just think that the best way to do that is just to try to score as many goals as you can and hope that your defense and your goaltending can carry you through, because, I mean, that's what got them here, and I think that's going to be the thing that could get them through if they could pull off the huge upset.
23rd best team in the play-in round gets to sit at home and watch today's games to figure out who it's going to play. That's just great. James, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Made us all smarter. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
James Naveau of the Madhouse Podcast, NBC5 Chicago Sports, and he and Jay do a terrific job, and you heard why. There's just terrific insight there. Speaking of insight, there's Mr. Thayer over there. Mr. Thayer, we can't go a show having you on without talking about quarterbacks if we're talking about Bears. And there are many things to discuss, quarterbacks and offensive coaches and things like that. So we will do that after this break. I'm Steve Rosenblum. He's Tom Thayer. It's Saturday Suckage, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's going to go. Alvarez ties the game.
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Bears.
It's Mark Grody. He'll be with us in about an hour. Mark Grody's usually on this show, but he's not on the show. But he will be on the show at 1:20 to talk Bears with Tom Thayer, who is on the show. Tom Thayer is sitting in for Mark Grody. Mark Grody will be on this radio station at 3 o'clock. And the Bears are the Bears. And Tom Thayer is here on Saturday Suckage. I'm working overtime to try to keep the good name of Saturday Suckage alive. Tom is defying me by being so eloquent and complete and stylish in his Bears answers, and we cannot go a Bears show without discussing. Oh, by the way, before we discuss quarterbacks, we have plenty of time to bang on them, but the moms that come up here, we learned today. Tom, you may not know, on Saturday Suckage, moms play a very important role on this show. They are active personalities in terms of the way they manifest themselves. Mama Thayer just became a part of this show. She became a part of the fabric with you telling us the story because of my love for Mama Thayer's chicken noodle soup. And the use of pepper is so important in that. And she was on her hospice bed, and she's, for those of you who joined us late, Tom was telling the story about how Mama Thayer was telling Tom how to pick out a good chicken for chicken noodle soup. And that joins a long list of moms on this show. Jean Grody, Mark's mom, would often dress Mark, tell Mark what he needs, make sure he had a winter coat for those games in Minnesota that might have been outdoors, or that in Green Bay, all that bad weather stuff. And our producer, Trash Panda, Alice, who's married to Shooter, would have updates on the Shooter shooting out of his window at Trash Pandas. So we think Alice. Does Alice have an update? Trash Panda, by the way?
Oh, well, not really. They're doing some redesigning of the porch this weekend, it sounds like, but that's it. The animals don't seem to be a nuisance, that or she's not telling me about them. So maybe she's listening and she'll text me. We'll find out. But as far as I know, there's not really an update other than they're getting rid of the porch swing, which I'm upset about because when I visit, I like to sit out there in the mornings and drink my coffee. It's very peaceful out there. It's very quiet. Maybe you get a breeze going, but there's no city noise. They're out in the middle of nowhere. And so now I'm just going to have to, I don't know, I'm going to find something else to sit on.
Why are they getting rid of the porch swing?
Well, they never use it. So I mean, it makes sense if they don't use it. I visit, you know, I don't visit as often as I probably should. I haven't visited at all since the pandemic's been going on. So, you know, I guess it's not worth it to them to keep it around for me to use three times a year.
Well, what does it cost them to have it there? It's not like they're renting a
It doesn't
a
cost
porch
them anything.
Swing.
It doesn't cost them anything. I don't know why they're getting rid of it. So
and Shooter can just sit on it and swing and fire his gun and hit whatever he hits.
See, exactly. They can use it for all sorts of things. So I guess my dad's going to chop it up, probably use some of that wood for various firewoods. And, yeah, there we go.
So, Tom, I want to thank you for adding Mama Thayer to our list of moms as they become personalities on this show. That's a very important part of this show.
Can I add one more story about my mom? Because I think the
you can add all the stories you want, Tom. We're here for it. This is the mom show.
I think the role that female support plays in the life of athletes is the most important element of a guy or a young lady, young man continuing to play. So when I was a young kid and the Pop Warner football program started in Joliet, there's a guy named Rocky Carnegie, which is the perfect name to start a young football program. And he came over and said, I know you have two sons. I would like for them to come out and try the Pop Warner program. My brother Rick was great immediately, and he loved it, but he was a running back. So now I'm going to practice, and I'm a young offensive lineman, which is no fun. You don't do anything fun if you're a young offensive lineman. So my first 2 years of going to Pop Warner practice, I used to cry every day, and I used to almost hide so hopefully my mom wouldn't find me. But because of her perseverance, every single day she drove me to practice to Pershing Grade School, and I'd be crying the whole way. And then she'd stop the car, she'd push me out of the car, and she goes, you'll stop crying when you see your friends. You'll stop crying. So it was almost like she knew it. So I would put my helmet on, and I would walk from the sidewalk to the practice field. I would walk up and see my friends, and then I would stop the crying and start the football prep. So if it just wasn't for her perseverance, the resiliency, her not letting my tears turn her around, I would have probably never played football. But because of her and not letting me, you know, have the tears dictate what I was going to do at that young age, she was the deciding factor, and she's the reason why that I really, you know, made it to that next level.
I love that story. Did you cry with a lip on, or were you, were you a blubbering crier? What kind of crier were you, Tom?
I was a pouty, fake tears, trying to, every reason in the book of, every same thing that every day she woke me up from school for school. Oh, I got a headache, or I'm sick today. No, you're not. Take an aspirin and go to school. And it was the same thing with football. You go to school, you come home for about a half hour, and then you start wrapping it up to get ready to go to football practice. And like I said, I whined every day about it, but every single day she brought me in, told me to get out of the car, and I'd stop crying when I see my friends, and it worked.
Oh, my, I love that. So what would Ferris Thayer's day off have been like if it was Ferris Thayer?
Oh, you know what? I was born in 1961, and I was a sitcom TV-watching baby. And if you go back and you want to talk about every show from Barnaby Jones to Cannon to Mannix, all the way to, every Hanna-Barbera cartoon to Ray Rayner, Frasier Thomas, Family Classics, all of them. I was the youngest of the kids at that point, and so I was a lazy kid that sat in front of the TV, and my mom and dad weren't having it.
No, they were going to take you to football practice and tell you to stop crying, and you see all your friends, and you get to hug them and all of that. So, we had a discussion when Grody was on, because Grody does Let Me Put a List Together podcast, and one of the ideas was coolest private investigator, your PI, because my guy is Jim Rockford. I love Jim Garner. So Jim Rockford, and they have it noted at Paradise Cove up in Malibu in California, that was where they filmed it. That was the place where Jim Rockford lived. So of all the TV detectives, who was your favorite? Who was your guy, your hero?
There's nothing better than a Sunday night Mission Impossible episode, but it kind of meant that school was the next day, and that kind of took the thrill away from it. But Mission Impossible, I love when they lit that wick and started the episode. But, I was everything from Get Smart for the clueless guys, or although, Adam 12 or every one of those shows that I mentioned, I could probably sit there and watch an episode and within 5 minutes tell you what it's about.
All right. Well, the critical question of somebody sort of your age was Marsha Brady or Lori Partridge?
Ooh, I'd probably go with the Brady.
Okay. I'm with you on that. With you on that. Okay. So we have agreement here, and we love Mama Thayer for just, I'm going to stop the car, and you're going to stop crying. You'll see your friends and you'll enjoy it. And every day, and you never learned. Well, I guess you learned. But we're glad for the Mama Thayer story. Thanks for sharing. We are the Mom Show. We have great stuff from moms here. We are going to get great stuff from Maddie Lee of NBC Sports Chicago. She covers the Cubs. They're not playing. We'll talk about why they're not playing and what's going to happen next when they are playing. Saturday Suckage, Thayer's in for Grody, but Grody will be here within the next hour. That's just the way Saturday Suckage works. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Everybody was good yesterday. I think everybody was like, okay, we'll just take it as players are, if I go back to my playing days, like no matter what, you kind of welcome an off day, in the middle of a long stretch. And so the first off day is always nice, relaxing. When you're getting ready for a game and somebody tells you it's canceled, it's really easy to shut off that mental grind and that physical of where you might need to get your body ready. And, talking through some things and how hard these guys have been playing, kind of giving the position players an extra day today.
That there is your 2020 National League Manager of the Year, or Manager of 2 weeks. He's David Ross. He's talking about the Cubs playing, not playing, weekend in St. Louis, weekend canceled. It's a little crazy. Let's see if we can get the story straight and figure out where this goes now with the Cardinals having played like five games. We're going to the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Joining us now from NBC Sports Chicago is Maddie Lee. Maddie, welcome to Saturday Suckage. Did you know what you signed up for when you agreed to come on this show?
No, I went in completely blindly, so I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah, we're excited to see, too. So the Cubs and baseball, the Cubs were supposed to play a series in St. Louis. It's not being played. Nobody knows when that will be played. Is that right? No one knows when the Cardinals will ever play again. And so what is this? Set the situation as you know it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary there. The Cubs now, you know, they went into the weekend thinking, hey, we're going to have three games in St. Louis. Now they had, obviously, yesterday off, they traveled back to Chicago. Today they're doing a light day for pitchers and for position players. It is optional. Tomorrow they have a sim game. The next day, as David Ross said, they're doing something fun, some sort of competition. We don't know what that looks like yet, but there's a lot still up in the air. Like you said, when the Cubs will make up these games, who's pitching on Tuesday in Cleveland. It's a very odd situation and very 2020.
You know, Maddie, there's so much unique events that can happen in a season like this. But, you know, a guy like John Lester specifically, you kind of get him into a rhythm, you get his body moving, and then he, you know, feels confident from one start to the next. How do you keep that in him? Because you don't want to slow him down that much to get ready for his next start. You kind of want to keep him into that rhythm, what you were able to achieve to this point.
Sure. I think it helps that he's a veteran for sure. You know, he's been through not this specifically before, but, you know, had to adjust to different scheduling things, disrupting a rhythm, whether it's a rain out or whatever it may be. And David Ross pointed out, like, hey, they just went through this crazy 3 months off and handled that really well. So for the pitchers, at least, you know, this is not ideal, but at least it's not as bad as having 3 months off and then 3 weeks to ramp back up.
Talking with Maddie Lee of NBC Sports Chicago. She writes about the Cubs, and she's talking here on The Score with me and Tom Thayer. So the Cardinals have lost a bunch of games, and they would have to make up 55 games in 49 days, which is a lot of doubleheaders, probably require some rule changes, and baseball's tried to be as nimble as possible. And I don't know, the Cubs players have said this on any Zoom, but I would imagine they have additional reason to hate the Cardinals and the Cardinal way for infecting baseball and getting in the way of the Cubs' run. The Cubs seem to be in a wonderful situation, a cocoon of we'll play baseball, we'll be disciplined, and they'll be rewarded with that discipline, with victories. That seemed to be the way things were working for this team. They seemed to find joy in winning games, and it was all worth it because that's what they do. I don't know if any of the players have spoken about that, but that's a feeling I got from way outside.
Yeah, we definitely heard some guys mention, like, we're on such a good roll right now, you don't want that to get disrupted. John Lester honestly called this earlier in the week. He's like, this is just my opinion, but I don't think that we're going to play the Cardinals this weekend. So honestly, MLB should have just gone with John Lester's gut and scheduled them to play someone else this weekend so that they wouldn't have to deal with, you know, stopping and restarting. They could have just kept going on this roll. But yeah, other than, you know, that 13-2 loss the other night, the Cubs have looked really solid even in their losses. You know, we can talk about the bullpen. That's another discussion. But great start to the season. I think there is probably some disappointment that they couldn't just keep on carrying that momentum through the weekend. And, you know, momentum in a weird season like this can play a big role because you only have 60 games. And so if you get on a streak, that could decide the season for you. So definitely some disappointment there. But, you know, this was bound to happen at some point, especially once you saw this outbreak come to the central divisions. You knew that it was going to affect everyone's schedules in some way. So Cubs were not blindsided by this by any means, and at least they're in a much better position to make up a handful of games. You know, you hope that there aren't more down the line, but so far just a few games, you know, one from the rainout and then three from this weekend, as opposed to the Cardinals, who, like you said, we don't even know when they're going to play next. They already, if they can start, you know, immediately starting next week, are looking at a lot of games in very few days. Real tough situation, even if they can get this virus under control super quickly.
Hey, Maddie, when we came back to this section, this segment, David Ross was talking about an unexpected day off during the course of a season is welcomed by players. But now it's not a day off, it's almost a week off. You have a first-time manager. What type, who do they have an advisor between David Ross and Tommy Hotovy who could even explain how to go about the next week, since we don't have anybody who's ever lived through this type of baseball, through the most experienced managers to even the young guys like David Ross?
Right. I think something that Tommy Hotovy said even before they started playing rings really true, because we kept talking about, like, hey, first-time manager, really tough situation. How's he handling it? And Tommy Hotovy was like, well, even the most experienced managers at this point don't have a playbook for something like the COVID-19 pandemic. So, you know, it doesn't even matter that he doesn't have this type of experience. He is able to use the experience he has as a player as much as well as anyone who has, you know, been managing for a decade or whatever. So, they're constantly talking. Obviously, as they're trying to figure out what to do with the rotation, that's going to be a lot of conversations between David Ross and Tommy Hotovy as they're trying to figure out the best ways to attack this pandemic. They do have that compliance officer, Vijay, who also does their traveling and just a ton of things. He's their compliance officer, so that's in his court, so to speak. So there's a lot of conversations going on between David Ross and his coaching staff and everything. But, yeah, there's no perfect playbook in order to handle this. But David Ross has handled it as well as you could ever imagine.
Talking Cubs on the Score with Maddie Lee of NBC Sports Chicago. Steve Rosenblum, Tom Thayer with you. One of the storylines was this season, since we're talking about David Ross, was – how would David Ross manage his friends, people he won a championship with? There's a difference between calling out a teammate when you're a player in that clubhouse and calling out a player when you're a manager and you're in a different room and a different office and a different strata. And on the one hand, we saw he wasn't going to settle for any crap from Craig Kimbrell. You suck, get out. I'm bringing in somebody who can get out. And he was the guy who went down there and told Theo, yeah, Kimbrell's got it. Sign him. So this is a guy with a vested interest, and he knows Kimbrell can't get people out. So full marks for that. Now, the question about Javi not running out a ball he should have run out and David Ross saying it wouldn't say anything. Do you believe David Ross didn't say anything? And what does that say if he really didn't? Because that was a moment that needed to be noted. Or is that David Ross showing how he manages friends by protecting them publicly and maybe taking a piece of paint off their backside privately?
You know, I do believe that he didn't say anything. I think that's one of those moments where, and David Ross addressed it after the game, where, like you said, publicly he talked about, hey, Javi's always working hard. This is not, it's not like you see him dogging it every day. I think he just thought it was a foul ball. I didn't say anything was what he said over the Zoom session, and I do believe that. I think it's a situation where Javi knows that was a mistake. You know, when you look back at the replay, he really barely got a piece of it. That feels like a foul ball to a, you know, seasoned player, some guy who's been doing this his whole life. And then between the wind, I'm not making excuses. Obviously, you've got to run that out. But I think what we hear from a lot of players is that the great thing about David Ross that has translated from his playing days to his managing days really well is that he will shoot you straight. He's not going to sugarcoat things, and that goes for guys that he's known and played with and for the new guys. He's going to shoot you straight. And the guys really appreciate that because, you know, I think a lot of ball players are natural BS detectors, right? But they know that he's played this game. He understands it from a player's perspective, and they really respect what he says. And a situation like Javi not running out that ball, yeah, not a good look. But David Ross doesn't have to say anything in that moment for Javi to know, like, oh, man, I messed up there. And so I think that's where David Ross is balancing that. Like, if it did become a consistent problem, I think you'd expect him to say something. But it was one moment where a guy knows that he's messed up. So does it actually do anything to, you know, chew him out? I'm not convinced that it is, and that it would, and obviously David Ross did not think so.
Maddie, when you look at the pitching staff here, there's a tremendous amount of respect for John Lester. That's obvious. There's huge hope still for Yu Darvish, considering the way he finished up the season last year. But how fortunate are the Cubs to have a guy like Kyle Hendricks that can fill a void, can throw a lot of pitches, can really go out there and perform well, keep the bullpen out of the game? But really, if they need to reconstruct the way the staff is going to go about its business after this layoff, how fortunate are they to have a guy like Kyle?
Yeah, it's hugely fortunate. I think what you said about the bullpen just then is absolutely one of the biggest things. You saw him throw the complete game to start off the season. Amazing. And with a bullpen that at best you could say is unproven, at worst you can say has proven that they are not reliable. Granted, we've seen a couple good bullpen performances recently. I don't want to take that away from them. But, man, anytime that there's, you know, just a couple run lead, you are not sure at all how that game is going to go. So definitely huge. And Kyle Hendricks is a guy who has been so consistent for this ball club over the last 5 years. You know, his first few starts, he went from being lights out to having some struggles and then working through some struggles really well in his most recent start. And he credited a lot of that to his catcher, which I appreciate as a former catcher, but just having Wilson Contreras really get on him and absolutely continue to get better throughout that start. So he's definitely a guy who just adds consistency. We all know about his poise on the mound and his inability to really get thrown off mentally. So that's huge in this rotation, especially with, you know, two guys moving up in the rotation that we didn't expect to, you know, with Chatwood be so high in the rotation because of the injury to Quintana. And then, obviously, John Lester's more conservative approach to the offseason that had him bumped back to the number four starter. And then Mills, who ends up being your fifth starter due to that injury. Other than Chatwood's start the other night, those two have been big surprises and have given them two really good starts, but a piece. But Hendricks is absolutely a really consistent guy, and consistency is key in this kind of season.
Maddie, thank you. Thank you for the knowledge. Thank you for stopping by and joining us on the maiden voyage of your visit through Saturday suckage. Wasn't too bad. And I hope you can clear off the whatever kind of suckage stuck to you. It should come off with basic bar soap. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Maddie. All right.
Maddie Lee of NBC Sports Chicago, talking Cubs. We're going to take a break when we come back. Tom, we're going to do, even though Grody's not here, we're going to be doing What Are You Doing, Wagner? And it's a segment where we started, well, I'll explain it later. And don't you trouble your pretty little head over it. You just sit back and enjoy this, okay?
Yeah. Very well.
Okay. All right. He's not there. I'm Steve Rosenblum. Saturday Suckage, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.